Welcome to Connectify Conversations. My name is Sean Topshi, and I'm the Director of Business Development at Connectify. Our mission is to share the experience, expertise, and insights from gaming industry leaders that comes from years of navigating the complexities and impact of compliance. On this episode...
My name is Joseph Martin. I'm the CEO of Connectify.
My name is Ari Tuckman. I'm the CEO of Quantifind.
Thanks for joining us today, and remember to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can also learn more anytime at Connectify.com. That's KINECTIFY.com. Ari, thank you so much for joining us on Connectify Conversations. Really excited to have you today. Would love for you to give us a bit of a background on yourself and kind of how you've arrived at where you are.
Yeah, sure, Sean. And first off, thanks so much for the opportunity to speak with you guys today. Excited about the conversation and excited about the partnership as we do explore ways of being disruptive within the gaming industry. My background is a little bit random. I'm coming actually out of academia in atomic physics. I was teaching at Stanford, working on quantum measurement. I ended up leaving academia to start a company called Entanglement Technologies, working on using quantum sensors for landmine detection. And if you think about trying to find a buried explosive, and again, not usually how the conversation starts in an anti-money laundering KYC kind of application, but if you're thinking about trying to find a buried explosive, if you're lucky or unlucky, as you may have it, there's about one molecule that will float up and evaporate into the air out of about a trillion molecules of regular air. So it's a proverbial needle in the haystack problem. And you're trying to find that one nitroaromatic explosive molecule among a trillion normal molecules. So what we found as we were building the company is that while we started off as kind of laser magnetic field quantum machine guys, we very rapidly were becoming machine learning people. And understanding how to do that signal processing and really find that needle in the haystack was what, you know, a little over 10 years ago was what I fully shifted into. Just about then, we ended up spinning the artificial intelligence component of our quantum sensors into a standalone company. And that was the birth of Quantifind. And we decided to focus on doing these rigorous predictive kind of needle in a haystack finding models, specifically on unstructured data. So looking at massive forums and news feeds, billions of articles. And really, even before the Gen AI hype of the last year, you know, has sort of swept the nation, we were using very precise language models to be able to find risk. And that was really the journey. So it has been a bit of a random walk, but incredibly fulfilling.
That's an incredibly interesting background, probably the most unique one we've had on this podcast in terms of how you end up getting into, you know, the anti-money laundering and the gaming side of the world. So I'm really curious, I mean, with obviously working on detection of landmines, kind of spinning this off into this new model, is it because that was in the defense contracting area that you started off kind of working at like the government level and eventually made the shift, or kind of what was the journey there?
Yeah, exactly right. When we started the AI company at Quantifind, our first customer was the government. So we had, you know, my contacts when I was in academia, I was mostly government funded. And when we launched Quantifind, those were the folks that I called up. So we did a bunch of work with the defense intelligence community, specifically trying to help them find hidden risk in news feeds. So the first example we worked on, and this was all unclassified public data, there was a terrorist group called Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement that took over the Japanese embassy in Peru in December of 96. And by looking at Reuters news feeds, we were able to then in 2010, 2011, pull out who was working with who and understand hostage taking patterns and really look at all these news articles coming from Latin America to be able to really chart a lot of that terrorist infrastructure. So that was how we started. And I think as we started working more with the government, the opportunity of actually using the same product and using the same sort of risk discovery from an anti-money laundering perspective became a very natural fit. So, you know, we've been really laser focused within the AML community for about 6 years now, but we started off doing this for defense intelligence, finding risk from news articles.
with that switch over to the commercial side, what kind of industries have you already worked with that you're deeply entrenched with, and what kind of interested you about, you know, the gaming space really to jump in with us as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, most of our work is with banks on the private sector, and
of course,
there's an enormous opportunity to really be disruptive, both from a cost reduction and from a signal discovery perspective, right? Banks have enormous requirements, and the number of investigators they have can be in the thousands for some of the top banks. And the process is incredibly, increasingly critical as we're sort of having threats from terrorist groups, threats from Russian oligarchs, right? I mean, discovering those hidden network threats is incredibly important, but takes a lot of manpower. And therefore, working with the banks to be able to automate a lot of that investigative process. And again, you can only automate if your accuracy is incredibly high, because no one wants poor accuracy automation, right? So really being tested to have best in class accuracy and translating that to be able to automate a lot of what banks are doing to discover hidden risks within anti-money laundering. What's really excited us about the gaming industry, honestly, is the bad guys target the weakest link in any ecosystem. And when you think about sort of the economic infrastructure in America and globally, casinos play a pretty significant role in terms of money movement and in terms of the ability to take advantage of it if the systems aren't good to launder money. And again, no matter how good a job you're doing cracking down on AML within banks, if there are other avenues like crypto or casinos or real estate or art or other avenues, again, the bad guys are going to go to the weakest link. And I think as we've been watching, there's an enormous opportunity to help casinos find the risks, right? And very efficiently focus on where the threats are so that we can close that hole.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Ari. Like, one thing that really attracted me to your company is what you're talking about right now. Like, these criminals find the weakest link, yet there is a lot of data out there, right, to have to go through. And having worked across banking and cannabis and gaming industries, and being the user of these tools and just seeing the amount of white noise that's out there, if you have a common name like my name, Joseph Martin, just screening that on a negative news screening is a very difficult task, because you'll have thousands and thousands of news articles to go through and then watch the screening too. I spent time as well, like in the Middle East, right? And you're talking about like Arabic, Latin American countries are similar, where you have these common names. And sometimes the spellings aren't exactly the same. Exactly. Like Muhammad could be spelled 17 different ways. And so, you know, one thing I found so interesting about your approach is this whole name science and your methodology around that. Could you spend a little time kind of talking and walking us through what, you know, your approach to that and what this new name science methodology is?
Yeah, sure. And it's a great point, because if you don't have the kind of level of accuracy to know which Joseph Martin you're talking about in a news feed, and you're spammed with hundreds of articles, you're just not going to do it, right?
Right.
It doesn't make sense to do it. And then you're kind of giving up, right? So the accuracy becomes an enabling technology to actually leverage all these news sources. So the way we think about kind of our modeling approach is a few different components. The first one is exactly what you were referring to, which is kind of the name science, right? And that's treating a name like an incredibly rich piece of information. It's not just eight letters in a row. It has ethnolinguistic roots, right? Which country does it come from? Which type of culture does it come from? What's the rarity of that name across 172 different countries? So we're a lot more confident if it's a rare name than if it's a more common name. And it depends on what country you're in. And certain names have Latin roots, certain names have Icelandic roots, and understanding kind of what that root is lets you be a lot more accurate in terms of what that name is. So that goes into a lot of it. Understanding cultural permutations, right? In certain communities, mother maiden names become the middle names. And therefore, when those individuals are covered in the press, well, if they're being covered in news articles in Latin America, you may have a different permutation of last names and middle names and maternal names than you'd have if it was press elsewhere. And we've built that into our models, right? So that becomes an incredibly critical part, you know, which, as you pointed out, we call that name science, but it really comes from recognizing that a name is an incredibly rich piece of information. It's not just eight characters that are random, right? And by leveraging that and building models to that, we can be a lot more accurate. The next part of it is really understanding risk involved, right? And that comes from first defining what risk means, and then just sort of modeling how to associate that risk with the entity that you accurately extracted using name science. So in terms of understanding the risk definition, the ecosystem of gaming, of banks, we kind of have to have the same definition. If we're trying to find a bad guy who's potentially affiliated with human trafficking, what does human trafficking mean, right? And that's that definition. So we use a lot of the techniques from generative AI. We use word embeddings, which is basically just a fancy large matrix for every word, a very large dimensional matrix that lets me basically have a mathematical representation of all the terms that could sort of co-occur in a risk topology associated with human trafficking. And then we actually partner with NGOs, with nonprofits. So we partner with Polaris, we partner with United for Wildlife. We partner with a lot of NGOs that have incredibly experienced industry experts. So we kind of get the best of both worlds in defining what the risks are. We discover emerging terms and associations that the industry experts haven't really seen that often yet, because it's an unsupervised machine learning discovery. But then we have their feedback, and there's lots of things they know on the edges that we don't know and we're not going to discover in our models. And we add that in. So it's really been a really nice kind of public-private partnership in even defining what those risks are. And then the third leg, right? So leg number one is the name science of let's make sure we get the right Joseph Martin. Number two is let's define our risk topology so we actually know what we're looking for. And number three is linking the two, right? And that's where a lot of these language models become incredibly powerful, because if you just do a bag of words approach and just say, hey, is there a term that shows up in my risk topology and also shows up in a sentence, you're going to be flagging risk on the victim as often as you're flagging risk with the criminal. You're going to be flagging risk on the judge as much as anybody else, or even the reporter, right? And therefore, what we're able to do is really understand sort of the language nuance, which then lets you accurately associate those risks. So those are kind of the three pillars of it. And of course, the fourth pillar is it's got to be fast, because if it's incredibly accurate, right? I mean, these are teams that are understaffed and are probably, I think one of the exciting challenges about the gaming industry is just how large it is, right? And the scale that entities have to be able to process. If your algorithms are brilliant, but they take years to process, it's not going to work, right? And that challenge of accuracy plus scalability is really what drives us.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like what you said about the judge comment, because that rings true to me. When I was sitting in the seat going through these articles, like if I had a judge's name, that was one of the hardest enhanced due diligence reviews I would have to do, right? Or KYC reviews, because they would show up in every bad article there ever was, but they were innocent, right? They were the judge. Right. And so with AI, there's much more sophisticated ways to be able to search and search terms and search names and all of that to be able to cut down these false positive rates. Could you maybe take a minute to kind of talk about some of those, like your case studies and the end results of these new methodologies that you're deploying?
Yeah. I mean, look, first off, even just on the sanction screening side, we've been able to reduce almost by 80, 90%, depending on the firm we're working with, their false positive rates on the sanction screening, right? And again, that goes back to, if you're just looking at a name as a string of characters, then you're going to match things that shouldn't be matched, right? And, you know, we work with MoonPay. They've been, you know, giving us a great public case study, and they've been a wonderful partner for us. And we've been able to massively reduce, I think, up to about 90% the false positives on their sanction screening, right? And that just means that good customers can sign on, right? And they don't get blocked. And, you know, when you think about the customer funnel, obviously, the AML KYC process is there to discover risk and keep the bad guys out of the system, but you don't want to keep the good guys out of the system. That's what drives the business, right? And therefore, the ability to kind of really have low false positive rates, just even on the onboarding side, is critical. And then, of course, that same low false positive rate and the ability to automate. We've seen with some of our banks the ability to automatically process 30 to 40% of the alerts that get generated. Right. And that just means that folks don't have to manually look at those alerts. Right. And we can triage them and we can hibernate them. And as we're screening a full screen of the entire customer base, again, with poor accuracy, you don't want to bother with adverse media because you would need hundreds of new investigators to look at all the noise that gets thrown up, right? So you're just not going to do it. We're at, for one of the banks we work with, we're doing 5 million customers every single week. For another one, we're doing 50 million a month. And the number of alerts that we generate on those can be handled by a very small handful of people, just a few people, because the false positive rate is really low. And that becomes enabling. And that means you look, and it means that you don't have to do as frequent deep dive. You know, you talked about some of those judge cases where you're doing those deep investigations. If you don't have an automated AI continuous monitoring, you have to do those manual deep dives more frequently. But if you can every single day, every single week, do a continuous screening on adverse media for your entire customer base, then you can reduce significantly how often you need to do a manual screening. And that ends up saving a lot of headcount, and it finds risks way before you would have otherwise.
It's really impressive. Like, we're seeing AI make such huge impacts, especially in the gaming industry. And it's pretty new. There's things that we're rolling out right now that have similar stats, and it's hard for people to believe, like a 90% reduction on false positives and things like that. Totally. It's like, when I used to do KYC reviews and I would do enhanced due diligence reviews, I had a dirty name string and I would have about 100, 150 terms, and I would use Boolean searches. You'd have like quotation marks, and you would have and or statements and things that would work in Google. And then I would get smart and do date ranges in Google and things like that. But it was very like, it's very archaic, or it's just this blunt force instrument. And then you get these issues, like we're talking about the judges' names, you're talking about these other things that come up, or a prince, like a Saudi prince goes and plays and gambles like all the time. And his name comes up in so much press in Saudi and European news that it was just really difficult to get through that. So there are these technologies today, and it's really exciting to me and to you, I'm sure, as technologists, that we can get more sophisticated in the way that we're searching, and it can make huge impacts. One thing that Sean is especially has a close pulse on is the differences between land-based operators and online operators, and the systems and technologies that they use, and the struggles, the pain points that they have with doing things like mass media monitoring and the resourcing and capabilities that they have, and KYC reviews. There's like so many different entry points at a land-based operator that a lot of times the risk-based approach traditionally in land-based gaming has been different than online. But with technologies like this, there could be an evolution. It'd be really interesting to get like Sean's thoughts on that.
And to your point, Joseph, and also going back to what you said, Ari, is, you know, with the gaming industry being such a big space, it makes it interesting. But also, it's because the gaming industry is such a growing space still, right? Like, banking is a little bit different in that, in some way, shape, or form, you know, banking is in most parts of the world. Gaming is still new on a legal basis, at least, you know, in a lot of parts of the world. And then even what type of banking, like Joseph noted, you know, brick and mortar versus online gaming, you know, online gaming really is, you know, we're seeing the growth of it now in the United States and other countries, and, you know, even possibly the introduction of brick and mortar facilities in, you know, places in the Middle East where maybe Sharia law previously would have prohibited it. So I am curious, you know, with online, I think we see them have a more tech savvy outlook, a little bit more of, you know, modern technology applied to what they're doing. And so they have kind of that mass, you know, more of that banking approach of how they look at the sanctions. But to Joseph's point, it's so much more limited in land-based now. How would you apply kind of like your lessons learned and what you've seen from these industries that you're already working with? How would you apply those best practices into the gaming industry to kind of be disruptive, like you're saying, but still be able to do it in a way that manages cost?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think an interesting parallel is what you have in alerts within banking, where you have kind of alerts generated by a teller experience, right? And then you have alerts generated by an online experience, right? And the narratives are going to be different. The information you have is going to be different. But, you know, at the end of the day, those are just features going into a model, right? So, you know, if you have a teller who writes an alert in a bank and says, you know, client A dropped off a bag of cash and it smelled like marijuana, you're not going to get that obviously in a digital type of alert, right?
Sure.
Online. But you get different ones. And look, I mean, I think what digital, both banking and gaming, has opened up is just an unfathomable scale, right? Because it just, the volumes explode, which really pushes the need for accuracy even more, because it's just, it's too massive a volume to be able to handle with anything other than AI technology. The other thing is, you don't know your customers well, right? And therefore, when you're looking at customers online, you don't necessarily have complete information. You don't necessarily have correct information. And therefore, you have to be able to understand better how to sort of suss out with incomplete information whether this is the person you're looking at, right? And a lot of those lessons force the any sort of screening platform to be incredibly accurate and fast, right? Which means it's kind of a feet to the fire test, which then when you go to land-based, you've kind of been through that rigor, right? So in some ways, land-based is easier. And therefore, applying a system that's tested at scale with less information and still has to work well, then when you go to land-based, I think you have something that can be disruptive very quickly.
That's a fascinating way of looking at it. And I like what you said there, because I think when some people, and I've heard this in the industry pretty often, right? They think of online as having much more information about the person. But with land-based, what you physically see is information, right? The ability to physically verify this person is here and they are who they say they are. So you kind of eliminate this whole layer of information, you know, that's needed in a sense that makes the models easier to work. And I don't know that a lot of people look at it that way in the industry right now. So I really wanted to call out that point and just hammer it home, because I think that's a fantastic perspective.
Yeah, if you're a 20-year-old man in a casino, you can't pretend to be an 80-year-old woman. But online, you can, right?
Absolutely. I think the other thing that's interesting is modern technology approaches. Like a lot of land-based casinos have very outdated technology, and they have on-prem servers and things like that. And so their watch list screening has been kind of outdated, right? Where you have models that have to be uploaded to a server and everything's localized and running local, which means you can't get real-time updates. You can't scan media real-time all around the world. There's a lot of limitations. And gaming organizations are looking for outside providers, right? And we have like API integrations and different types of technologies now, where someone like a Quantifying, like you could come in and you could augment the existing systems in a casino. And as there's multiple entry points with different types of software at the cage and the host systems and all these different areas where personal information is being collected, that information could be verified through integrations in those existing software platforms. It'd be kind of interesting to kind of hear your approach to the clients that you're working with when there's like multiple entry points or multiple softwares that you're integrating with to kind of service like a wide range of applications.
Yeah, it's a great question. And that goes back to, if you don't make the experience seamless and easy for the casino, for the gaming industry, they're not going to adopt it, right? I mean, you want to make things easy. And look, what I love about the partnership with Connectify is not everyone has modern API integration, right? And you know what you guys have built to have that seamless integration, at the end of the day, the customer benefits because it's a lot more economical. The chance of, you know, copying and pasting data from some of these archaic systems, they're very error prone. They don't, right? An integrated system like what you guys have built, it's updated continuously. It's incredibly modern. It's fast. And all the data feeds are in there. So I mean, you know, our integration with you guys was easy and seamless, right? We have clean APIs that are rich on both sides. We know how to send it. You know how to catch it. And it's just been great, right? So I think that's where, obviously, you know, I think these economic systems, whether they're banks, whether they're casinos, whether they're big corporates, they're complicated entities, right? And they have lots of siloed data and they have lots of applications and lots of different business units. And it doesn't make any sense economically for any of these institutions to have siloed data, siloed solutions, right? Manually copied data. It has to move in a direction of you have a platform and you have clean API integration and you can move things around with proper security and with proper controls, right? And yeah, you guys have that great. And it's been, you know, it's been wonderful to plug into that. And I think we're really seeing that make a difference, but not everyone has that, right? And I think the world will get there and the first movers will benefit first.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. And that's how I view things too. I think kind of platform as a service model, when you're talking about anti-money laundering, makes a whole lot of sense. And when you're talking about responsible gaming and fraud and everything, it makes a whole lot of sense too, because there's data in all these different places in the casino, right? And there's always been complaints in the casinos, in the land-based casino gaming industry, that oh, all our data, the systems don't talk to each other and our data is old and there's no way for us to pull it together. But there is, with third-party providers, like a platform like Connectify, where we can integrate, you know, with multiple points, or we can work with the IT team often to gather the data on their servers and then get it into a report that's sent to us daily. And then once that feed is coming into Connectify, now you have a modern platform, and now it's sitting there and we can normalize it and standardize it and then connect to parties like a Quantify and doing really cutting edge things. And it's a very easy API integration. So it solves so many problems for gaming organizations, especially the large ones that have large volumes of data siloed in different places. So a lot of people, when they build technology, they think of it like it's an engine and it's just going to produce a result. But in reality, I think in corporate America, including gaming, people don't have time to make a user interface, and they don't have time to try to like develop that expertise in these different areas, especially with risk management. And if you can come in and deliver a turnkey solution like a platform and be like, use this, all your workflows and everything's here and all your data is here, I think there's a lot of value in that.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add to that, Joseph, is the only thing worse than not having time to make your own user interface on the kind of the client side is having 12 groups each make their own, right?
Right. And
you're talking to a bank and, you know, there's literally, yes, then all right, what are you guys using for, you know, your UI platform? And it's like, well, Bob's got this and Jim has this, and right. And then like, you know, that's a mess waiting to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Another point I think we were thinking of are languages, right? So we're talking about the gaming industry here, and one struggle with the gaming industry has been outdated technology and this data siloed and a lot of manual processes. And one of the big solutions to that, like we're talking about, are these integrated platforms. You take, ingest all the data, you have it standardized, you have it in a platform, and you have connectivity to groups like Quantify and other third parties that can do really incredible things with that data, like watchlist screening, native news monitoring, and all that. Looking beyond that, in the gaming industry, what adds complexity is even with a platform that normalizes and standardizes your data, your customer base is from all over the world, right? Lots of people from Asia, lots of people from Latin America, some very wealthy individuals from the Middle East. And these are all common customer groups for gaming. I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you're able to kind of weed through the noise when we're talking about, you know, foreign names, foreign languages, and be able to reduce those false positives and get to good, clean results. And in addition to that, like on that question, it's very related, is a lot of times people have really struggled with international data sets. So if you could kind of talk about your data sets as well as the, like, foreign language capabilities, I think that would be really helpful to gaming, because they're so used to these older risk management type watchlist screening technologies where they might have some lists from around the world, but when you're talking about news, it's mostly US based and they're really limited when they're talking about international data sets.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I mean, gaming is international. There's massive increase in the Emirates and in parts of Asia. And, you know, and again, like we talked earlier, an ecosystem is only as strong as its weakest link. And that work, that's true for correspondent bankings in Eastern Europe, and it's true for the gaming industry in other parts of the world. So critical to solve that problem. You know, solving the international kind of risk analysis problem, as you pointed out, it's the data and then it's the models, right? From a data perspective, we have global news, you need to. We have foreign language news. Now, there is a difference between machine translated news and machine translated risk topologies and native. And it's just more accurate when you're doing the risk analysis in the native language. So, you know, we can do machine translated risk analysis in you know, every language out there. And those are certainly helpful, but we're sort of, and just, it's hard work, right? Where we're knocking away at it is bringing in native language risk from native languages, right? So what we have in our product, so again, machine translated languages for every language out there, 170 something different languages, but native language risk for Spanish, for Portuguese, for French, for Cyrillic. We, you know, that was, you know, obviously a convergence of what our customers on the defense side needed when Russia invaded Ukraine, to bring in all that native language Cyrillic news. Chinese, right? We've done, you know, that's incredibly important for banking and our government applications. So those are languages we brought in. We're actually just pushing to production Arabic now, which has been a important need both on the government side and the banking side. So that's going into production, I think, next. next week. So I think the way that we've taken that approach is global data coverage. And look, certainly there are going to be parts of the world that have less data than others, right? There are parts of Africa where the news is sparse. The beneficial ownership information is sparse. We have what's out there, but it's not, you know, it's not equal. But I think you can also supplement a lot of the sparsity in some of the structured data by having long tail global news, because that is available. Yes, certainly more news in the US than there are in certain parts of the world, but you have news coverage from most countries in the world, and that's a good way to supplement. So you need that global coverage. Obviously, you need sanctions lists globally. You need PEP lists globally. You need beneficial ownership globally, and you need news from around the world. And making it even more accurate is the hard work of doing as much of that in native language as you can.
I'm so glad you brought that up with the languages you have rolled out and the languages you are rolling out, especially with that Arabic, you know, coming in the next week or so. Obviously, with new gaming jurisdictions opening up in the Middle East, and with the level of conflict obviously just exploding in the Middle East between Israel, Hamas, and Lord knows what other fronts are, you know, going to open up in that war, whether it's Iran, Hezbollah, and any other entrants. Gosh, it just becomes so much more critical and so much more important, especially as, you know, U.S. institutions are looking at possibly launching gaming in those jurisdictions. You're still held up to that same standard, but now you're dealing with a level of sanctions risk analysis that you've never had to do before.
Totally. And the other thing to, it's a great point, Sean. I think the other point to even make that stronger is just how dynamic it is, right? I mean, what we saw when Russia invaded Ukraine, we had one of the fastest rates of new names added to OFAC than we have seen in decades, maybe even ever, right? Where OFAC doesn't usually update sanctions lists daily, right? And you were getting, with Russian oligarch discovery, that was happening at an incredibly rapid rate. And we're going to be seeing that a lot more with Hamas as well, because while Hamas is a sanctioned entity, what we're able to do with very high accuracy is understand who their friends are and, you know, money coming from Qatar, money coming from other places. And again, the more accurate you can determine the risk of an initial bad guy, the more you can look at their friends, the more you can look at their friends, right? So just very simply, if you have a negative news solution that's 10% accurate, by the time you're looking at 1 degree of freedom, it's 1% accurate. And you go 2 degrees of freedom out, you're talking about 0.1% accuracy. Don't even bother, right? Like darts, a monkey throwing darts is going to be better than that, right? We start off about 90% accurate, which means when we start looking at a Hamas terrorist network, 1 degree of freedom out, we're still 81% accurate. And 2 degrees of freedom out, we're still 72% accurate, right? So it really changes the game of, can you actually think about almost anticipating where those new sanctioned entities are going to come, right? So while legally, maybe you can, if you decide to sign on a customer, sign on an entity who's 2 degrees of freedom, connect 2 degrees of freedom connected to Hamas, but that might be a sanctioned entity 2 weeks from now, right? And therefore being able to stay on top of those risks, almost like from a predictive perspective of where sanctions might be coming from, that network analysis, I think, really changes the way you can get control. And at the end of the day, casinos, gaming, land-based, digital, they're going to make risk-based decisions about what they want to do. Our goal as a platform is to give them all that information and help them understand, look, here's where there's a threat, right? You guys
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. I think one thing that I've run into is having conversations with gaming organizations, opening up jurisdictions overseas, especially in higher risk jurisdictions like the Middle East, UAE, would be, a lot of times they're like, well, the government does name screening when people enter the country, and so we can rely on that, right? And they feel comfort in that. And I'm like, well, that's great. Like, if the government does, that gives you a little more knowledge that at least you know the person's name is accurate and like some of their basic information is accurate. But it would be great for you, since you're an expert in the space and you deal with this every single day, to comment a little bit on that misconception or that thinking and why watchlist screening, negative news monitoring, is really important, especially if you're located in a higher risk jurisdiction, even though the government might have good like ID verification when you enter the country.
Right. I think your last point is definitely an even if, right? Like, you know, governments, obviously it varies wildly by governments, but certainly in the regions where you're most concerned about there being high risk, often that's going to be a government that is not doing the same level of careful scrutiny on that sanctions list as you might hope, right? The other question is, what are they screening for? There are lots of sanctions lists out there, right? And a country is legally only obligated, even from their own laws, to do a screening of the folks on their sanctioned lists, right? There's hundreds of sanctions lists. Most of them are redundant. A lot of them are, you know, outdated, but the number of sanctions lists is enormous, and they're not all relevant. They're not all useful. But, you know, if you're going into Turkey and they're screening for the sanctions lists in Turkey, that doesn't mean that they're screening for EU, they're screening for OFAC, they're screening for, right? So I think there's an whereas the gaming industry moving money around between internationally might actually be responsible for a much broader sanctions watch list screen than just what the country upon, you know, kind of customs would be screening for. So I think that's, you know, that's a one key part in terms of like, what are they actually screening? What are those lists? How good is their name matching technology, right? And, you know, their incentives are not necessarily the same. And, you know, I think relying on that in certain parts of the world is probably not a great thing to rely on. How frequently are their lists updating, right? So I think all those things, you know, passing the buck is convenient, but I think in the end, right, the gaming industry is going to be responsible if they end up, you know, blaming the government, well, you let this guy into the country, probably isn't going to fly.
That's such a good point, Ari. And I think rarely when we do see new jurisdictions come up, rarely is it just local operators that are propping up, especially when you're talking about these mega resorts, right? It's existing brands or it's existing online operators branching out into these countries, whether it's an MGM, a Wynn, and Entain, a Flutter, right? So, you know, for them, that really, that country is probably just the tip of the iceberg with sanctions that they have to deal with. They're probably in the UK, different parts of Europe. They're in the United States, where there is a whole other host of sanctions, a whole of list of other countries they consider bad actors and individuals within those countries. So, I mean, it has to be to the highest standard for those, you know, companies even to be able to comfortably operate.
Great point. Yeah, completely.
And I think like ongoing monitoring is the other side of that coin, right? It's like, even if the country does a great job, that was just a snapshot in time, right? And what happens on day two, day three, day 10, day 50. And a lot of times with sanctions lists, you know, I worked at a company and all we did was investigations into illicit finance and sanctioned actors. And what you see a lot of times are sanctions actors will have family members and things on boards of directors and things like that. Companies, right? And the US government will say things like, you know, if they're 50% more or more in control of that company, then they're sanctioned by law as well. And those names aren't on any list, right? So you have to know about them. But in addition to that, that's how the government branches out. They kind of figure out who's on the boards of these companies and how these people are, their familiar relationships and stuff, because that's all fairly public information. And that's typically how they start adding those names to the sanctions list, right? And so someone might enter the country not on a sanctions list, and they might be in that country for 6 months and they end up on a sanctions list. And then what do you do there? You're kind of exposed.
No, that's a great point, especially like we were talking about before, the dynamic pace of names being added to the sanctions list, whether it's due to the Russian conflict in Ukraine or whether it's due to Hamas terrorist activities, we're seeing an incredibly rapid rate. So folks that enter a country, they can end up on the sanctions list the next day, right? And I think that's a great point. And yeah, I love the point you make about the 50% rule too, because that's a hard list to maintain. And that takes a lot of work to understand what that looks like. And that's not something most governments are going to be screening for. So I think, you know, in summarize, I think the two points there are, A, government screening upon entry is not going to be as comprehensive from a list perspective, and it's going to be outdated. For both in scope and in timing, I think that's going to be a dangerous thing to rely on. Yeah, all good points.
That makes sense. I think one question I have for you is, where do you see the future going for watchlist screening? Like, we've talked a lot about the huge strides that AI has made and what you have done with AI technology in this area, watchlist screening and negative news monitoring. But there's so much untapped potential, right, with these technologies, and they're evolving so quickly, that where do you think, you know, the direction that your side of the industry, Watch the Screen, Negative News Monitoring, is headed, and give us a little insight into kind of where you see the future state?
Look, I think the holy grail is a fairly high frequency continuous monitoring with perfect accuracy, right? Because, you know, what you want to do is you want to be able to, you know, again, systems are dynamic. People that weren't criminals yesterday can be criminals today. People that weren't sanctions yesterday could be today. And doing a high risk screen of your customer base every year is going to let a lot of risk and a lot of bad actors. And that's going to lead to fraud too. And it's going to hit the bottom line in pretty significant ways. So where you want to head towards is a continuous monitoring, ideally every single day of every single one of your client base. And that's only possible with incredibly high accuracy. So, you know, we're at about 90% accurate now. Like, let's move to 95%. Let's move to 98%, right? I mean, I think it's, in some sense, it's a very simple vision. It's speed and accuracy, right? But AI has been enabling to do that. And look, certain things like a lot of the hype cycle in Gen AI gives you the accuracy, but not the speed. And where you have to be clever today is figuring out sort of which components of a generative AI toolbox you can run in the speed that these enterprises need. And, you know, as chip speeds get faster, then, you know, you can use more of that. But, you know, I think it's a simple vision of speed and accuracy that we want to work towards continuous monitoring of everyone with such a low false positive rate that you barely need more than a couple people to even handle what's being flagged.
Are there specific tools that are kind of helping you get that additional speed right now that you're working towards, like a goal you have in mind? Or is it just as you continue to feed these models more data, you know, that level of accuracy is eventually getting there? Is it a combination of both?
Yeah. So, I mean, from an accuracy perspective, that's dead on, Sean. And as you're putting in more features, they get more accurate, right? I think one of the challenges, and maybe, you know, just to go technical for a second here, is when you think about kind of the bigger movement in the world on generative AI, some of those models, whether it's from Facebook, their Llama model, or from OpenAI, you're talking about hundreds of billions of features, right? And that's why they're called large language models. It's an insanely large model. But making any kind of decision using one of those large language models takes a few seconds. So if you're thinking about how many decisions you have to make in order to process a name, a transaction, a risk, and you think about the volume, it's just not sustainable, right? So really what we've done is sort of ask the question, how do we take components of these massive large language models and reduce them to something that's scalable and executable in the runtime, right? So there's always going to be a trade-off, right? If you can use an 800 feature model and you can fine tune it and you can prompt engineer it, you know, maybe you get 93% accuracy instead of 92, right? But that's a trade-off I would make to be able to run this thing 100,000 times faster, right? But as chips get faster, as we learn to take more components, it's going to be that kind of balance of speed versus accuracy, just getting back to that, right? Like speed and accuracy, the holy grail is you have both. There is a trade-off, right? And really our job, the way we see our job at Quantifine, is to pull as much of the power from Gen AI models as you can without compromising on the speed, right? And make those, you know, you will take a tiny little hit of accuracy. I mean, if you just think about it, if you work on a problem for 10 years, you'll probably do a little bit better than if you work on it for 10 seconds, but we got to make that delta really small, right? So that we can be, you know, 98% as accurate as that 800 billion feature model, but 100,000 times faster.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. It's really exciting to hear your vision for the future and the reality that it's here, right? The models are built, the technology is here. It's just, you know, maturing these systems over time.
Totally. I mean, the only other thing I would add to that vision for the future, if we want to go utopian here, right, is different industries sharing data, right? Because again, right, like the ecosystem's as weak as its weakest link, and people do move money seamlessly from casinos to bank accounts to real estate holdings, right? Like to cryptocurrencies. And, you know, unlike certain things within the economy that are super competitive, this is one where, at least in theory, there can be a lot more collaboration, right? It is in a bank's interest, right? If a fraudster gets away with it at one casino, he's going to go to the next, right? If he's a bad actor, one. And the whole ecosystem benefits by working together. So, you know, look, folks are going to be rightfully, justifiably concerned about the privacy of their customers' data, but there are ways of anonymizing that data. There are ways of sharing that data. So maybe I would add a third leg to that, you know, vision of speed, accuracy, and data sharing. Yeah. I think data sharing ones are probably going to come third because folks have to get comfortable. But we have great AI technology to make that really secure too and anonymized. So that way you're really not compromising your, and I think everyone will benefit with that kind of collaboration.
Yeah, I think so. And I 100% agree with that. And it's been interesting in some European countries to see kind of their experiment in that area and seeing the technology that's emerging and the lessons that are being learned with that. We've seen some interest, you know, with our neighbors to the north on doing more robust systems that, you know, span provinces and things like that. And I think it'll be interesting to kind of see if those visions come to life and the technology that emerges there and if that model could be deployed in the United States, right? I think there's like culturally in the gaming industry, at least, there's been, you know, it's more like this is my data and I own it and I don't want to share it type thing. But like you said, the technology is there to anonymize it and create these environments that are secure. So you're not giving up any kind of competitive knowledge and you're only gaining benefits, right? From understanding trends across an industry and identifying risk across an industry or reducing the amount of times you have to hit a watch list provider, right? Because you have one natural person in a country instead of duplicating that same search across thousands of businesses, right? There's a lot of advantages in a lot of areas and the technology is there, but I think it will be interesting to see the way that emerges over time as people get to understand these technologies and the capabilities like anonymizing your data and what that actually means and what other countries are doing. Other countries that are moving a little bit more aggressively, sometimes they have different legal frameworks that they get to work in. Like in Canada, some of the government regulators and entities will like own the casinos. They have crown corporations and different things like that. So it's like a little bit different in a legal environment. And then in European countries, you know, it just depends on the cultural context and legal environment. But I just think it's going to be really interesting to see in the future that third pillar you talked about kind of come to life potentially.
Yeah. Look, like most great transformations in the world, like it takes a leader to step up, right? And I think that third transformation is going to happen when some of the bigger players, whether it's Caesars or MGM, and basically says, look, let's start a consortium of the three biggest gaming entities, right? Let's start working together here, right? I mean, it takes an amount of leadership, and that leadership will also step up the more they trust their technology partners, right? You guys are, you know, obviously significant players among the technology space within the gaming industry. As your guys' clients trust you and trust you to handle their data securely, then they'll trust you to handle the data on a collaboration. So I think, you know, it's a combination of trusted technology partners, innovative leaders that are willing to lean in a little bit, right? And that's, you know, that's how great change happens.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad you kind of brought it full circle with your comment prior, right, about weakest link or, you know, bad actors making their way from industry to industry. If it's not banking, it's real estate. If it's not real estate, it's gambling. Obviously, partial to the gaming industry here, having grown up in it, being from the Vegas area. And so I think it's incumbent on the industry, you know, with these new technologies, with online gaming coming, with these new, you know, provinces or jurisdictions that we're going in, adopting these technologies to make the industry as unattractive as possible, you know, to bad actors. So they jump to the next industry. And then of course you and Quantifying can go and help that industry out and make it unattractive again.
And the only thing I'd add to that, Sean, is make it as unattractive to them while making it as attractive to the good guys, right? You want to make sure that you're not turning away the good guys by being over-vigilant with the bad guys. And that's the balance that you got to strike.
Yeah, well, and I think that's what Quantifying, you know, just from what we've seen of the partnership so far, it's that reducing all those false positives, but also, you know, increasing the accuracy of the true positives. And exactly. That's it in the crux. And really excited to see where this partnership goes.
Yeah, likewise. I think we're off to a great start and a lot more great stuff ahead.
Yeah, we're really excited about the partnership and the technology that Quantifying is bringing to bear. I think one of the things that I love about our vision at Connectify and really why I launched the company to begin with was what we talked about before, creating this integrated platform where we could standardize and normalize all this data from all these different places in the casino, regardless if it's siloed or not, you pull it into one platform. And then as you standardize that and pull it into this modern cloud-based platform, then you have connectivity, right? We have these modern APIs, and we can connect to third-party providers. And we're really excited about what Quantifying is bringing to the table. And we've integrated that into our watch list features and our negative news monitoring features and deploying it out to casinos, such as the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians and the properties that they're involved with, including Caesars Southern Indiana. And it's going to be very exciting over the coming months to see how that performs with gaming data live and to see the kind of results that brings to bear for the industry. And as we onboard additional clients, then that is integrating the product, and, you know, client by client are going to get the advantages of this really modern technology for watch the screening and negative news monitoring.
Ari, it's been such a pleasure having you on. This has been a very informative and enlightening session. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Sean, Joseph, a pleasure to be here. Excited about the conversation today and the partnership going forward. Thank you.
Thanks again for joining us today on Connectify Conversations. You can support our show even more by leaving us a rating wherever you download your podcast and by sharing Connectify Conversations with gaming industry leaders like yourself. Visit Connectify.com to learn more. That's KINECTIFY.com. Until our next conversation, always remember to minimize risk and maximize your efficiency.